Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together. Whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.
Hello and welcome to another episode of My Property World. I'm Will Mallard, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Toby Wild. Toby, you're very welcome.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you so much for having me again, Will.
So Toby's one of the co-founders of Aparo, and you can look up Aparo online on their website, which is oparo.com. Is that correct? Or .co.uk?
.co.uk.
Okay, so that's aparo.co.uk. And you can connect to Toby on LinkedIn. And I'm sure there'll be some listeners out there that are mad to chat to you after this session. So what we're talking about is about Toby Wild, My Property World. Where did it all begin?
At birth, I guess. I have the pleasure or the burden, one might say, of being born to a third generation real estate family. So my family started off post-war, sort of scrap metal merchants slash general builders. It's called the Milne Group, or was. It was probably the largest construction company in the south of England until 1992, but it had just a development arm, it had an engineering arm as well. It also, my mum had the first regulated fund, one of the first seven regulated funds under the business expansion scheme of Maggie Thatcher. So she went and bought a load of residential properties. So I've jokingly put a photo on Facebook a few years ago of me at the age of five, dressed as Captain Scarlet on one of our building sites. And I was there. I was there with a paintbrush. I didn't have a paintbrush in my hand in the photo, but I was there with a paintbrush at five. But from 12, I was working as a labourer on my dad's sites. 15, after a rocky journey at school, I became an estate agent, never completed my A-levels and started working as an estate agent, really.
Where was this? Where did you start off in your own property career? So was it a high street agency? What was the...
So it was a it was a little chain of estate agents called Hodson's, which covered Oxfordshire. But yeah, very much high street, dealing with properties on the Lady Grove estate, principally, if you know the Lady Grove estate in Didcot. It's got the highest life expectancy in the whole of the UK. Built in the 1980s, just normal stuff, really, normal houses for normal people.
Very good. And as a young person in the office, what was those experiences like?
It taught me a very good lesson. I think because it's effectively an internship, it was quite a long internship, but I think it taught me something that was always very good. And I tried to get into motor racing when I was very young, and I was used to picking up the phone to people, but it. The first job they had me doing was calling through all of the applicants. And you've got to remember, this is back in, sort of the early 2000s. And so it was printed off about 300 pages, ream of paper of what people were, what they were looking for. And my job was to call through them all and see if they were still looking, and to see what they were looking for. And this was the year's worth of people. So, oh, you're not looking, you bought somewhere a few years ago. Do you want to sell it by any chance? And, first deal I actually ever did in real estate was a bit of land, which isn't sort of so much my mantra of normal stuff and normal people. It was a development site in Prior Court for I think six or eight houses. And a guy called up randomly and said, "Oh, I want to buy this land." And I was like, "Great!" So I took down the offer, yeah, taking, you know, basically price and how quickly they could do it. That's all I knew to ask. And I ran to the manager, and I was like, "I've got an offer." And he's like, "What do you mean? You haven't even done any viewings yet?" And I said, "What do I do about it?" He goes, "Tell the owner." And I said, "Who's the?" I said, "How do I reach them?" And they said, "Just tell them when you get home." And I was like, "What do you mean?" Turned out the bit of land belonged to my old man, and didn't even know it was for sale. Didn't know it was that part of my family's land bank at the time, which they were. It was about 2005, and my family were trying to dump all their land bank because they could see what was coming. They did as well. So they saved them from going under again in 2008. But yeah, it was a good learning experience.
Hmm. And those times growing up, like the one of the largest businesses, let alone property businesses in the country, things getting unstuck and restarting again.
I definitely wouldn't say we were one of the biggest in the country. I don't think that's a big stretch. But we were definitely one of the biggest. We were definitely the biggest in the Thames Valley, but we were one of the biggest in the South, if not mm-hmm. the so.
What was it like as a young person? You know, like you would have been very young at the time of effectively the transition from 30, 40 years of upward trajectory to things coming down with a bit of a crash, and then rebuilding, like the time that you go forward 8 or 9 years to 2000 and you're getting into your own property career, and your formative ideas about continuing to move forward. I imagine what were your memories of that time sort of and the feelings around that?
We're third generation, but all the credit needs to go to my dad, really, because when he took over the business, he took over the wheelbarrow, a spade, and an Austin 1100, and built it up from that. So he did very well. So the real credit needs to go to him. And when you grow up with a father who's quite well known and quite, you know, very accomplished in business, it is, you know, if you're interested in that business, then he's your hero, right? I know it was definitely tough on him, you know, and having to, you know, 92 make so many people redundant. I think that was hard for any entrepreneur. You know, I've certainly been in the position during my entrepreneurial journey where it's come down to the wire of whether I can pay my staff or not. And, you know, it's one time I had about 30 employees and it got to like the third of the next month and we still couldn't pay them. Luckily on the fourth, we managed to pay them all and had enough for another couple of months to do so. But there's nothing worse than not being able to pay people or in his case, he paid everyone and made them instantly redundant. But it took its toll on him, you know, as an entrepreneur. But he did very well to try and keep it aside from the family and the kids. I think there probably are. We were, you know, it's probably reprieve from dealing with administrators and dealing with receivers and dealing with, this general stuff. But it was remarkable watching the man. You know, my real memories, because, you know, we went under in 93. So the group was, by the time I can really remember, my memories begin at about the age of four. So it was already basically gone then. We had some legacy sites we were doing. Like, I remember going up to the top of a crane at St. Hugh's College in Oxford, where we were building their new campus or their new student accommodation. I remember things like that, but watching him rebuild that business is, and the resilience it took of in that, I think that was very impactful, because I'm a big believer in the most valuable attribute any entrepreneur can have. It is resilience.
Mm-hmm. We had a, I spent a period in the post 2008 as a independent business consultant, or sorry, doing independent business reviews within a large practice of development loan, basically failed development loan portfolios, and how to manage the way through. And one of the pieces of advice that there was an older guy on the team who must have been in his at least mid 60s at that stage, used to give people that were faced with tough decisions, was that it doesn't matter. You're either old enough to come again, or too old that it doesn't matter. And yes. And I always remembered that. And by and large, it was true. Most of the people, they moved on with their life. And not all of the cases ended in a insolvency. Like our, contrary to what most people think, the banks genuinely are motivated to keep things going where it's possible. And sometimes there's, you know, there's different situations in different markets, but and I think that's one of the challenges in development ultimately, is that you're the longer, or the bigger the development, the longer the time period, the more the market can move up or down, and it can take longer and cost more and be worth less, or you know, the reverse in all the cases, and all of those factors are not necessarily within your control. And what is you know, a good scheme, a great business can, you know, be caught basically with a. I had a really interesting call with a social housing developer that we might talk about offline, where they've got a land and delivery model, and their housing association partner funds it the whole way through. And so there's a certainty, but the certainty is also the prices are fixed where the costs are not. You know, the margin as inflation kicks in is being squeezed, and so it looks good at, you know, at one level when things are a little bit more even, but there's no perfect solution to this. And one thing I would say is that anyone listening, look out the window. Any building you see, it was built by someone, generally a developer, and there was at one point nothing there. It was a piece of land. There was a forest. There was a field, and someone had a bit of vision and a bit of vigor and a bit of go, and they managed to cobble up enough belief to raise some money, or to put their money in, or and put a plan in place and get it through all of the steps, the hurdles, and the building that you see out that window wouldn't be there without someone who was willing to take that initial risk. And for people to do it on a sustained basis over generations and decades, I take my hat off to you all. So.
It's. I've always been of the philosophy you should always try and take a 10-year view. I mean, it shows your empathy and likability. The fact that you could be in a job like that where you can actually go in and try and advise people and deal with the tough situations, because it's, you know, we deal with it a little bit with our, what we do with our technology business, and it's not always easy. I mean, we like to, you know, our technology is sort of multifaceted anyway, but. One of the elements is obviously the stressed real estate trading, where we provide people who need a dignified exit, really. We try and resolve things for them. But I mean, one thing I have learned, just picking up what you said, I think it's very tough when you get older, like your colleague said, because I mean, in real estate, there's really a 30-year window where you can get money because of the debt needed. So you're always going to be at whim to the banks. So 30 to 60 is effectively the time you can make money. After 60, you start becoming a risk, right, to banks. And I've seen that with my father and how difficult it was for him to get funding and finance as he got older. I mean, it was easier for, it was actually one stage when he was in his mid-60s, and him and I went and raised about £10 million worth, or a good commitment of £10 million of equity from a Indian family office. It was actually easier almost for us to get that than the development loan. And okay, I'm sure if we'd have gone to your Oak North and people like that, we would have probably got our development loans at 7%. But when you come with a certain amount of background and pedigree, you don't expect to pay on development finance more than 4.5%, right? Sort of one in, one out. But to get that kind of facility again was tough, and we got one, and then they pulled it. So there's that. But I have to say, I don't have an incredible amount of sympathy for the people who over-speculated, didn't control margins, did deals for the sake of doing deals. It's like, buying things to build them out at 10%, at 10% margins is lunacy in my idea, which in my mind, which is why I've never been big on new builds, because of the inherent risk of doing it. Expecting a 29% new build premium, which is the requested national average for a new build premium, I think is absolutely lunacy. And valuers aren't underwriting them anymore. So, effectively, obviously a bit more work goes into it than placing a bet. But if you're trying to build stuff out at a 10% return and forecasting in such high new build premiums, then I'm really sorry, you're placing a bet on the market. You're not actually working as a developer or a builder. And we've never felt comfortable doing that. I mean, what happened in 92 was, property prices truly went down. The national average was 15%, right? 10%. But actually, if you start looking at the areas we were, property prices went down 30% overnight, 30%. And then if you look at the interest rates, went up to 15%, right? But if you compare that to 2008, where property prices went down 15% due to quantitative easing, repossession levels were less than half, but I believe they're around a third of what they were in 92, and people have been continually bailed out. I don't really have much sympathy for people who take bets or take investors' money to run their own lifestyles and fail to deliver. I think there are a lot of problems in our industry that make me really sad, because you see the human effect on people, especially investors you put money with guys who just take them out to fund flashy lifestyles. And I think that's...
And I think one of the even more common than the misspending on lifestyle, if you want to call it that, is the extending into additional developments where you haven't met the milestones yet of the first one. And it's having good governance around what happens with ring fence funds and things, I think, is a really big part of protections on money. So not just on the equity side, but on the debt side. We had a deal that we were looking at where it's quite a complex thing, where there was a developer had a site, and they'd taken a portion of the raised monies into another site, and it was almost finished, but it wasn't finished. One of the contractors forced a liquidation action, and he was caught where he didn't have the money to complete it. Of course, as soon as the liquidation was actioned, a receiver was appointed. It was further complicated by the lender, who you might be able to guess, but we won't talk about, went into administration. So you had three layers of insolvency practitioner inaction on this one development that essentially just needed the services hooked up and a bit of a tidy up of the some of the properties, it could have been a great, very profitable development for the guy, but he went out the back door not even rolling the dice. I think it was, I'm not sure what happened in terms of criminal action against them, but it would, without seeing the technicalities, I think it would probably be justified.
There's quite a few of them, and I think it's tough, right? There's a lot of you're dealing with a lot of transactions, and you've got a lot of deals going on. Then you have to be very careful in terms of, good lawyers. That's also one of my top tips for people: have good lawyers and pay them well enough, but not too well. But more importantly, rely on them and rely on the indemnity they bring to you, right? Because their job is to protect you from doing stuff that by accident you can do, right? And I'm very, very, very conscious about all of that stuff, because it can turn really nasty really fast, and it can be completely by accident. And we've always been very, very careful to get all our lawyers to do all of that kind of stuff. But you have to ring fence you have to ring fence each product and run it separately.
And so did your dad sell the site or not?
Yeah, he sold it. Yeah, he got that one gone. I mean, look, he built about 3,500 houses, and he built I don't know, half a dozen university campuses and hospitals and stuff. Some interesting stuff, fire stations as well. Apparently, he told me he started off as a specialist building. I know the first job he ever did was building a factory. Then, having done well, first job he ever did was block paving a pathway to somebody's front. And then he quickly got recognized, and he got the faith of somebody to build them a factory. That was his first ever proper like construction job, new build, and at about 24 or 25, something like that. But because it was the market, right? Really bad market. Constructions it is a ruthless game. There's a lot more than the development side of things. You have to have really sharp elbows. But because he was always straight, and there was nothing wrong with the way the company had operated, and it looked very, very good, and he'd done his utmost as self-sacrifice to keep the whole thing going. I mean, the receivers actually gave him back a site to build out of 50 flats in the city centre, which is why he managed to rebuild something. Which shows, if you do it right and you do it honest and you treat people fairly and you hold yourself accountable when things go wrong and are always reachable, then people generally will give you the chance to rectify or to have another go, which is what ties into what your colleague was saying. Again, you're young enough to come back from this. If you're young enough and you're straight enough, then you can come back from it, right? But interesting, on that lender you were mentioning that went bust. I do know somebody, Martin, may rest in peace. He had a loan with them, and he tried to buy it back off them when they went under. They're 45 pence in the pound. So it was an opportunity for some people to make money, that one.
He overpaid, I think.
I don't know. Martin's stuff, actually, he had his problems. We all know that. He definitely had his problems, but he had a good heart. He wanted to do some good in the world. And people, he's always very transparent of, this is a risky strategy. If we lose it, we're going to lose it. Not that I'm here to defend him, but his stuff in the end, it sold, and it sold for what he said it would. I mean, and a lot of his sites that he had were taken over by other people, and apparently going very successfully now. I think he became more of the problem than the actual transactions he was doing.
And tell me, what were your next moves on the back of this land deal that you put together between the office and the dining table?
I think
What happened after that?
I think accidentally got an offer for it's probably a bit more accurate. I went and worked at a few London corporate agencies. I worked at another chain of estate agencies in Oxfordshire for a while, principally dealing with student housing and sales of investment properties, buy-to-lets, HMOs, to students. This is back before the days of HMO regulations and needing planning permission for it almost. So I was doing that, selling some properties, doing some lettings and management, and then I came to London. I got a job at a company called John Hollingsworth, which you're older listeners might remember. It was an estate agency founded in 1911, big in South London, and a couple of offices in the city with the Square Mile Property Group. So I worked there. They stuck me in at 17, 18 years old into their Fulham branch. 18 years old, I think it was actually 18, 19 maybe, into their Fulham branch in Parsons Green. First day I was told, great, you now run the office. And the sales manager left and I was there on my own running an office in Fulham, no experience. And just no idea what I was doing, really.
It's remarkable. I know a couple of other people that not the same chain, but Fulham branches where their first day or their first week that they've been given the branch manager as a new agent.
Yeah. It's a tough market, Fulham. It really is. And it's very, well, it was good back then. Back then you had all the Kiwis and the Saffers and the Aussies there, and it was a good laugh. But it was a good liquid market back then. I toughed that out for about 6 months trying to do it. Compliance basically kept calling me up saying, well, you've let somebody move in without an EPC, you can't do that. And I'm there going like, no one's ever told me, I've never done this. I literally, my job has previously been opening doors and selling people. Mm-hmm. And that got me hit, like running a branch.
And you're supposed to be training the other agents on how to do it.
There was no other agents. There was none. I was given an office in Fulham to become an estate agent. But the problem was, and I didn't do great fees. Like, I'll be honest with you. I think in 6 months I did like 40 grand in fees, 50 grand in fees. So not really worth the effort for them or for me. But I was like, this is ridiculous. I've got no idea. Like, even I recognized I needed to go and work under someone at that point and learn the industry, right? Because I'd been working at Hodgson's, which is a very professional agency, this other little chain, which was, just really badly run. And my job was really opening doors. But I got really lucky. I interviewed a few places, was told I was too arrogant to go and work for Savills, a blessing in disguise looking back. But the people who took me on was a lady called Jane at Kinley, Folkard and Hayward. And I have to say that's what made my career, because not only did she give me the freedom to be a sales lunatic like I am, but to actually professional. I mean, they had the stock as well, right? So I went into the Fulham branch, and in my first full month there, I won the Negotiator of the Month award, which, there was 250 negotiators working in that company at the time. It was the second largest agency in London. First full month, I won the award, right? And the reward used to be they'd give you a Porsche for a week. Mm-hmm. But because I was under 21, I couldn't be insured on it. So they every like 4 to 6 months, they did give me a brand new company car, a brand new Golf. And then my one, which would be trashed by then, would go to somebody else. I mean, they really put up with a lot of shit from me as well. Like, I wrote off 2 cars in my first 2 weeks there. Like, yeah. One was not my fault, though. I got a Barmaid bank van smashed into me on the M4. And the other
And what sort of stuff were you selling?
I was lettings then, because that was in 2000. That was in 2008. So the whole market had collapsed, right? 2007, actually, 2008. And the whole market collapsed. So I went into lettings because the only way to make any money. I was doing very well. Top 2% of salespeople my whole time there. I really enjoyed it as well. But then I moved to Asia for a while, lived on the beach. I saved up some money, thought I was rich, went and lived on a beach and read lots of books, came back, set up my own little lettings agency, and then had about 1,200 beds under management across 200 assets at one stage in that business, sold that. And then got into more developments and refurbishment.
Mm-hmm. Talk us through the sales process. That's always an interesting part of the. Did you have it in mind like before someone approached you, or did you take it to someone? What was going on, and what was going on with you at the time?
You mean the business? Sorry, I was thinking about the sales process for sales lettings and things. But I will throw something out there in case there's any budding estate agents out there. And I always like to say to people, it's a really good career, but not in your career, it's a good proving ground. Nowhere else can you go to learn. If you go to a decent agency, nowhere else can you be paid such a high amount of money to learn actually how to do real estate, right? Because you still are on decent high five or six figures in central London, and you know, regionally, you know, obviously London living costs are twice as high and everything. But anyway, point being, there's anybody out there who wants to be a lettings or sales agent, this was, I learned this line very quickly and it served me in good stead. It was, at the end of every viewing, I just say, what do you think, how does it compare to the other ones you've seen? Because you've got to realize in life, and it took me a while to realize this, you can't sell people who don't want to be sold, right? Asking that simple question allows them to say, get to express interest, and then your job is to ease them over their anxiety of actually making the purchase, or it is to or it's to say, okay, I'll look for something else. Because once you lose the interrelation from them trying to sell to them, and you're in trouble. Anyway, in terms of the business, it wasn't really a choice. The business was going downhill. The margins were not good anymore. We grew too fast, took on too many properties too quickly, which we, you know, we went to 200 properties in 6 months, 200 assets in 6 months. And it took us a while to realize why. It's because it was all the properties and that no other lettings or management agency would touch. And, you know, I remember one landlord once.
There's work and then there's hard work.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. I remember once we gave back 70 keys to a landlord of 70 houses and said, they're yours again. Because he ran up a 30 grand maintenance bill with us. 30 grand, because he would be happily let his tenants stay there without any hot water for like months, or, you know, like roofing issues. And you know, like, because we call him up and say, you've got to replace the boiler, and he'd go, yeah, let's do it by the next tenant. He'd be like, that's in 3 months. He'd say, yeah, yeah, do it then. I'm like, no, mate, I'm doing it today and you're paying for it. But of course, then he wouldn't pay. And it would just, you know, it was, yeah, he just had no, you know, the boiler was 40 years old. You know, he's had people around to fix it 3 times in a year, and they're telling him every time, this is a patch, it'll last a week, get a new one put in, and the guy won't do it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, the business was in the decline. By that time, the partners I'd set it up with, we were all just wanting to go separate ways. We got a couple of offers, one from Countrywide, one from Martin & Co. In the end, one of the partners agreed to buy us out. But I mean, I would say that's a good learning lesson of sell to the biggest person, take the cash as quickly as you can. Don't do people favors because they're your friends. I learned that it wasn't a big amount of money, but I never really got paid what I was owed for that business in terms of shareholding. So always better to sell to somebody you don't know if you have the choice, mm-hmm. unless there's an emotive reason for the sale, of course. But there was no emotion. I wasn't doing it for emotion. I was doing it just because it seemed easier at the time. And it would have been easier to sell it to one of the big PLCs who offered, because they were just buying the management book. You know what I mean? It wasn't worth
the
money.
And within the partnership of that business, what was the dynamic? What was the, who was doing what? What was there a plan? Was there a strategy? What were you doing?
Branding, marketing, and sales, really. That's sort of what I did. Dealing with customers, doing some of the back office stuff. But there's a couple of, there's only ever three of us there. None of us really crossed paths that much. By the end, but there's one guy handling all the finance and accounts and all that kind of stuff, and then sort of two of us on the sales side, but I mean, it's, I was already moving on to other things. Like we only did that business for, I don't know, 3 years, I guess, something like that, 2-3 years, but I was doing other things anyway. I was focusing on the development, so I was trying to do stuff for my dad, and I was looking at launching a platform at the time called chainships.com, which was meant to be a for return ships, mm-hmm. you know, the return ship. So I thought it'd be a really good business in getting an employment platform specifically for people who've been out of work due to, you know, health reasons, or, you know, having a baby, or just, you know, mm-hmm. unemployed for a long time, to actually get like an internship for adults who just sure. wanted to change their path. So I was looking at that, but yeah, anyway, I ended up doing more with my dad, to be honest with you. First time I ever really worked with my dad, and we didn't, as I said, we didn't really have much success. I spent a whole year looking to buy deals, couldn't find anything to do.
And why do you think that was?
Land prices continue to go up, and this is after Brexit. Land prices are going up, house prices are coming down. There was just nothing worth doing. Everything also because we didn't have the network anymore of land agents because we hadn't built anything since, I guess, 2008. And, you know, Oxford, there's nothing to build in Oxford left anymore, right? And even if you do, you've got to pay 25% for the S106. So we started looking more, which is where I sort of, I talk about Oxford a lot, but I really grew up in West London, to be honest with you. It's where I consider home. I never considered Oxford my home, but it just happened my family had a business there. But it was just too difficult. And agents kept wanting too much money. And you look to build stuff out, like I said, and the agent would tell me, you're definitely get your 20%, your 20% margin on this, right? Bear in mind, I came from a generation brought up around my dad when it was a third, right? And it still was to the 2000s. Mm-hmm. But then I'm getting told 20% by big agents. But then I'm looking, I'm like, 10% is the return here. And they're like, yeah, but you've got to factor in capital appreciation. And I was like, are you taking the mic? I said, I'm not going to factor in capital appreciation. And even the comps they give you, like, you know, they tell us your comps and you speak to the same agents they said they got their comps from. And they'd be like, oh, they'd say it was worth 20% less than this agent was telling me. And then I say, well, I spoke to someone you didn't speak to, which would say KFH. KFH was a great one. I spoke to KFH in Muswell Hill, right? And the agent actually had the cheek to me, said to me, well, they're not very good and they don't have a strong presence in the area. And I'm like, they're the second largest agency in London. They've got the number one sales in Muswell Hill, yeah? And you're telling me they don't know what they're doing. I was like, listen, if you'd said Foxton's overpriced things, I might have believed you, right? Because they had a reputation at that time for doing it. But when you tell me someone like KFH doesn't know what they're doing when they're the number one agent by sales in that postcode, I'm going to tell you you're taking the piss out of me. You know, like, it's, frustration.
And that process of analysis deal that at the pre-acquisition sort of stuff, what sort of volume of opportunities would you have looked at over that year or so?
Like I said, I didn't have access to deals back then, which was a hard thing. I had money. Me and my dad had the money from India. And we had the experience and the knowledge, and you know, I had the sales experience from a lettings point of view, but I didn't have much construction experience. I'd done a couple of like refurbs myself by that point and PM some. But in terms of deal flow and how many I saw, it was just what the agents were bringing to me. So it was all market stuff almost, and it was just tough. As probably saw 50 new build sites at the time, about 50, but all of them at the time were just too bad. And, you know, and I didn't, there's elements that there's deals we should have done that we didn't know because I didn't have the intricate knowledge of ways, workarounds that I developed over the next sort of 6-7 years. Like, you know, I kick myself now for turning down an old industrial estate in High Wycombe for 250 flats because it was an industrial estate and because it was car servicing and it was contaminated land. Yeah. Now I'd love to get myself my hands on some contaminated land. I would have done 6 months afterwards. I found out that I should buy as much contaminated land as I can. Like, and but you don't know. Well, you don't know, right?
Yeah, I think like problems are problems if you're not geared up to provide a solution. Like and thinking about solutions is often where you can see value where others can't. And the opportunities for exceptional super profits usually come from making something out of a bad situation or a bad property as perceived by everyone else.
Well, it's, look, fortunately, we live in a country where we know at a local level there's big problems with NIMBYism, right? And planning. But mm-hmm. at a national level, there are incentives to help you build, right? There are things, and you know, I throw out contaminated land because I think it's probably fairly well known by now. Anyone who doesn't, who sits there thinking this guy's nuts talking about buying contaminated land, you get 150 pence back in the pound for decontaminating the land, so you're already making money. So that's why. So if you can buy contaminated land at retail value and then clean up the land, whatever that is, the remediation cost, say it cost me £1 million, you get 1.5 back, right? They might have scrapped it in the latest budget. I don't know, because I'm not building stuff anymore, not even looking to, I'm doing conversions, so I don't know. But yeah, there's that's one point I'm working on, is when you have the work of the knowledge and the depth of knowledge.
And there's an interesting sort of theme emerging here where you've got this access to the funds. So you're dealing with this family office, you've got funds, but being able to deploy them and find the right opportunities and to do it in a timely fashion and for it to actually be dealing in reality, which is where a lot of people will just keep tweaking it until it looks like it might work, kind of, sort of, not really, but they do the deal and it's totally dependent on market uplift to have a chance of getting, you know, anything near. And they end up, you know, under pressure the whole way through. Maybe they come out the other side, you know, almost washing their face.
Yeah.
And you've got this awareness at this point. There's all this money, but nowhere for it to go. And you've also been investigating the tech opportunity, and I can see where all this is headed. So talk us through these next steps. This genuinely, like your current business is, I think, a great idea, and I can see how it's almost happened by accident through the circumstances that you're in the preceding years. So tell us about this.
Okay. Well, I think one of my strengths is I'm very opinionated, and I think some people find me very difficult to get on with because I'm very direct and I don't suffer fools gladly. But I'm very opinionated, but I'm very strongly opinionated, should I say? But I'm completely willing to change my opinions. and they will they do change, of course. I came to the realization that the new builds were vanity, not sanity. And you know, I've got a big enough ego without having to build big things to pump it up anymore, you know. But I got so frustrated with my dad and the rest of it. A guy approached me at the time who, there were two friends, basically, older guys than me, much older. One of them's in his 70s now, and the other one's somewhere in his 50s, I guess. But one of them had an idea of building a full service history for your home, much akin to when you build a used car, which is a great idea. And then George came up with that idea. And then the other partner, Matt, started to think about how you could actually, you know, who would use it and actually more the business case for it. So I sort of, you know, we're coming from a state agency background. They approached me about it and asked, what do you think about full service history for your house? And I said, well, this is great, but can we start bolting on all the stuff that I naturally do for my due diligence as part of a development appraisal? Mm-hmm. You know, we can get all the data that I'm currently having to spend 7 to 10 days getting on every new build site anyway, or, you know, even refurb.
From updating different sources of and platforms and, that don't match up nicely in a database.
It's crazy to think, right? People think I'm going to be nuts when I say this, right? But no, I'm not. Look, it shows how far the world's come. 2015, PropTech was Rightmove and Zoopla. Mm-hmm. That was it. Like, you know, that's it. That's basically all you had, right? Like, flashy London agents could afford Lonres and things like that. But in reality, data wasn't widely available. So aggregating all that together in one place for the first time with the addition of the full service history for your home became a very good idea. And that became Sprift, sprift.com. So that became the largest centralized property data platform in the UK by paid users. It's still going. It was almost listed on the stock exchange last year, but it's now in discussions for a takeover, I believe. According to rumors. So that's a very exciting business, or was. I enjoyed making it, but it's, you know, I was working 22 hour days, you know, selling to state agents in the day, going out networking at night, selling the memberships. I shook the first 2000 users' hands of that. We didn't pay any money on marketing for that business while I was there, apart from a couple of stands at a couple of events. But I realized that there's more value to be had by me going more back to my roots, using data and technology to make more informed investment decisions. I was also very fortunate in that the guy who actually ended up building Sprift was a old friend of mine from Fulham who I've known since I was a knee biter, as it were. But I've known Paul 15 years, something like that, 15 years, I guess. And he was the man who came up with the original uncompressed audio streaming site, which I could play in. You just integrate into a MySpace and Bebo, if you remember them. Very good guy, gets data, resilient, but entrepreneurial. He's one of the very few people I've ever met who is tech, entrepreneurial, and just like me, for years of sacrifice, never give in. He sees the objective, sees the goal, and it's once he's committed, he'd rather die than give it up. He's so tenacious. It's the best partner you could ever wish for. So we started building Apparo, which became the first sort of algorithm-driven real estate investment in the company in the UK, focusing firstly on financially stressed assets, but now we also look at sort of other flags within our thousands of data points per asset to look for motivations to sell. We monitor about 500 million data touch points in real time, looking for the right opportunities.
And that's it's not a new business concept, but a UK focused at that level, like there's some, quite a reasonable history of US focused hedge fund backed equivalents. Now, you've come from a really interesting, just rewinding back a step where, as opposed to a pure tech or straight property, but you'd actually had a little insight into the fund side. So what's a family office need? What's the volume, the level? It's a different ball game.
It is. I would actually disagree with you in terms of a strong business model in America. When we launched, after we launched, actually, I didn't know about them beforehand, but they predates us by about a year in America. One company called Skyline, which I think is probably the one you're alluding to, Skyline.ai, which are an Israeli backed company, but they were the only other ones in the world when we were going, which is why I can only say the UK, not the first in the world, give them the credit they're due. But then there's a couple more that were in sort of development road at the same time as us. But I think what really differentiates us is we've always owned and built our own technology. We don't buy in. There's certainly some people out there, competitors I know of, there's about four or five competitors now, who really don't have much technology, or they buy it in terms of and don't process.
And you've got another thing going on in the background. So that there's, and it's a fintech as a general category, which PropTech is loosely part of, evolved out of banks, IT departments, people seeing an idea, leaving the company, forming the idea, selling or contracting it back to the bank or through the bank's supply chain in some way. And the in-house hedge fund property search / data gathering, they've been, but to do it on a available to multiple funds at the scale that you guys are doing is fascinating.
Well, we've got, because I know that you've had Aaron on the show before. I'll answer your original question now. Sorry, I get excited when I talk about property, but my New Year's resolution is to talk slower, be calmer, listen more, and be less angry. I think
how's that excited. Working out so far?
No, I have to say,
you haven't lost it on the show yet, so the angry bit definitely.
No, it's, you have to do a lot to get me angry, but
it's not a challenge, by the way.
it's better to be calm. It's when you're trying to
hold.
If you're calm, I believe that or my New Year's resolution is, because I've come to the realization, I believe, that if I'm calm with people and I actually answer their questions, and rather than just assuming my knowledge is obvious to everyone around me, which it's, you know, we'll, especially when you have different aspects of the business, you'll need to, but it comes easier on me, but dealing with me, because I'm not always easy. But anyway, going to your original question on funds. So we have two sort of core models within our business, which is we invest on our own balance sheet. We've done that quite heavily this year in the social housing space. But then we also do, algorithmic based trading as well. But on, we basically represent people, which is Aaron's side of business. I know you had on previously. Mm-hmm. So Aaron does trading on behalf of mandated partners, which I have to say, compared to buying on your own balance sheet, is a pretty tough gig, because you're at the mercy of their investment criteria and what they want to do in order to make money. And it's just, you know, it's a lot
and getting
easier.
That defined in a wide enough criteria that there's a volume of transactions at the time to put through is the challenge. Like I'm sure you know Jay Howard and Paul Ribbons. Extensive, you know, hundreds of individual trades, you know, where they're in and out, and there's all sorts of different versions of the contract structure, and how what the property is varies immensely. But in common with all of them is they see an opportunity and move quickly. And being able to do that when you're working to a mandate is a very difficult thing. And the tech requirement and the value that I think Aaron's end of the bargain is essentially the identification of that and being ahead of the game, basically.
It is exactly that. And also, you know, most real estate people still like to they're in and out, right? They want to make money quick, right? They want decent returns and all the rest of it. But it's, you know, real estate assets have an intrinsic value, right? And it's, you could argue it's subjective to a point, but I'd argue it's not to a point. I'm much more of a firm believer in that real estate assets almost have a fixed value, yeah? Which is why I quite like long-term income generating assets, because it is very easy to value them. So for me, it's a lot easier to find deals, because...
And value, to an extent, though, even in that context, is in the eye of the beholder. And I'll give you I've been looking at exactly this as an illustration. So going up into the north, you come across an opportunity where you're buying perhaps at a 20,000 per bed space with a, you know, maybe 10,000 per bed space refurbishment / other costs getting to the lettable condition. And then we'll just assume that you end up with a 20% yield on that at that point, which is unheard of, you know, in higher levels. But if you're doing in volume, it's great. You've got a value that on a bricks and mortar basis, it's still only worth maybe 30,000 per bed space. But to build that same bed space, you could potentially be looking at 60 plus new build, depending on what the land value and the spec, etc. But like for like, so it's worth twice as much to build. The valuation on the bricks and mortar basis, then you say, well, you commercialize it, you look at the, so what's the multiple that's applied, how's the yield? And if you get enough of these together, ultimately, you know, the value to a pension fund, provided you've got strong enough lease covenants and that income level holds up, or the net rental holds up, you could have taken that 25% down into a again, depending on the lease, anything from a 4 to 6% yield. And it's the same property, it's the same income, the lease being the key differential. And there's like, and you can play that out, there's 7 or 8 different values for that same piece of real estate. Now, but you're 100% right, at each of those 6 or 7 levels, the person, for the reasons that they're assessing it and the methodology that they're applying, it is worth that level. And it's having the, you know, the ability to see the differential and move on. And I think what you guys do is do that at an industrial level, essentially, is see that value.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we monitor sort of 5 million properties in real time. Four or five million properties in real time, with a view to giving you just finding the right stuff, really. But for me, I think you and I have a very shared ethos, and you buy and you keep and you hold, and you look for a decent return on capital for your investors, and you de-risk it, right? That's what it's all about. And that's why conversions and refurbs are a lot more comfortable for us, because it removes planning risk, it removes
Well, when you start digging holes in the ground or relying on like a consistency of what you're doing relative to what the political council may be, you know, thinking as far as what's acceptable or not acceptable, or and how that's implemented by an individual planning officer, who I think they get a lot of stick from developers that. But they're, you know, in general, they're good people who are, you know, they're doing a job, and that they've got an interpretation of what their brief is, and we might not always like what they're telling us, but it's usually coming from a good place, and that might be an unusual for a property person or an investment side person to be saying that. I think there is a massive value in, you know, effective both building control and town planning and planning regimes. Now, there's degrees of this, and what happens as a society is essentially what the bigger economics, macroeconomics is about. Like, do you need more houses? You need to make it easier to build them. You need to incentivize. And quite often, government policy actions end up producing the inverse of what the objective is. And there's I'm a New Zealander originally, and they've had a 25% increase on average through the whole country. So you can imagine in the last 12 months. Now, if that's the average in the country, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know there's some, you know, big variations in specific little niches within specific areas. Now, where a lot of this has come from, and this is in the backdrop where they've had a massive tightening of bank regulation in terms of the 60% loan to values on buy-to-let mortgages is the maximum, with the exception of a maximum of 10% of the loan book value at the time, which is the reason for doing it was to make housing more accessible. Now, what it actually has done is created this this enormous price uplift, which is the opposite to what the government was trying to do. And we could spend 2 or 3 hours listing off examples where a well-intended government policy didn't do what it says on the tin, or it did what it says on the tin, but it's not perhaps the meal that you're expecting on the other side.
It's unintended consequences of government intervention, right? It's
It's always interesting watching markets other than the ones you're operating in, when they're moving at like breakneck speed, where there's lots of moving parts and it's happening really quickly, because you get to see things and the effect of different things that you're not aware of when you're in the middle of the market. Like people in general don't have an appreciation that, you know, things are going to change. And your ability to forecast to see in the future effectively is basically what an investor should always be focused on. Like what's coming up? Like what is this going to be worth in the future? What are the risks associated with that? And especially always, what's the risk to the capital that's in play? And people talk about risk, and you know, it's the most commonly misunderstood thing. It's a number, it's quantified, and it relates purely to the money that's gone in and the likelihood of what portion of that not coming back out again. It's nothing to do with the other external factors or what the upside return ends up being, or the certainty of that upside even. It's what happens to that capital, or what may happen to that capital, I should say. And that all, you know, as a real estate person, it's all about, you know, and people talk about the market. There's so many markets in play in the real estate market, even within a tight niche. And I think the role of technology and quants and, you know, businesses like yours or the, you know, the tech arm of it, it's only going that way. You know, I don't know. I don't know what the latest stats are, but the trend is, you know, internationally and certainly in the UK, that there's a consolidation of the private rental sector. I personally think it's a good thing. And I've got a vested interest, so I can, you know, I'm quite happy stating the vested interest in that. But I think it's a good thing. Like you're talking about people's safety, you're talking about people's health, you're talking about the communities that are. And they can either be done in a big professional way where things are done right. There's a governance which is at a level which is appropriate to the importance. Like I think other than the food supply and the water supply, housing is probably, you know, number one in my opinion. Like, you know, you've got health not far behind and education sort of not too far behind that and security and law and order, etc. But housing is right up there because it affects all of those other things.
Exactly. They're all a byproduct of having a safe roof above your head, right?
Yeah. And you know, a comfort factor that you can walk out your front door and that the people who are in your neighborhood are also living in a safe, healthy environment that, you know, doesn't drive them crazy and doesn't, you know, push them over the edge to do things that you wouldn't want them doing in your neighborhood.
And do you know what the irony is, right? So I think people have a bit of a, I know we're about to do another podcast anyway, more about the actual business side of things, but more just back onto what we do as a business and how I think people see, I'm trying to think of a way around not sounding really egotistical or arrogant things, but how people perceive me, back me. Anyway, no.
That's enough about you. What do you think about you?
Exactly. So it's really hard to do podcasts and talk about your own background without coming across as a real arrogant person or rude. I don't do this. I'm not motivated by money in any shape or form. People would be surprised if I told you how much I actually take out of my companies or I've ever taken out of my companies. It's not that about that for me. I enjoy it, right? I really enjoy it. I like to build things. I like to build houses. I like to build businesses. I'm got ADHD, so I'm very manic. Like, I'm not manic, but like a fidgety and got to create to be entertained, right? But anyway, a lot of people have an opinion.
Energetic maybe, is how I would describe it, having met you, Toby. So
that you're being kind. You speak. That's kind of words that my own father would use about me. But anyway, Point being, I think people think because of the background I come from, and I'm very keen to point out, I didn't get anything from my family apart from fantastic knowledge and life skills that have allowed me to build my own businesses, right? And that's not a Trump way of saying they gave me £1 million and I did it all on my own. That didn't happen. I've done it all off my own back, and I'm very proud of that, and they're proud of that too, because yeah, they're proud of that. You get the hard cards you dealt with in life. You know, I could have taken over the family business if it was still going, and I would have been proud of whatever happened with that, but I didn't, and I'm proud of what I've done alternatively. But I think some people sometimes have an impression of me that I'm super prime, or I'm prime London because of where I live, or, you know, because of maybe my aura a little bit. People think that. I don't do that. It doesn't motivate me. It doesn't interest me. It's about normal houses for normal people, right? It's about people having a decent, safe family home above their head. And as you know, I operate a little bit in the supported housing space. And I've got quite a lot of stock down in Croydon, right, at the moment. And people are of the view a little bit like that it's unsafe to go there, or, you know, so people from here, from where I live and all the rest of it, like, oh, isn't it a bit dangerous down there? I'm like, no, it's not. Like, I had furniture turn up at one of my properties, including TVs, sofas, and everything to furnish it, right? And it sat outside that property because we didn't know it had been delivered. We didn't get any confirmation for 10 days. 10 days it sat outside there. Not one item was nicked. There's a community spirit down there where people will sit and they'll talk to you. And they're like, oh, you've bought it, have you? What's your, you know, where are you from? All the rest of it. People are actually friendly, want to talk to you. And I'd much rather spend time with people like that than I would half the people who live around me, to be honest with you, because they're normal, nice people who I can relate to. But then you deal with some other people in like the posh part of Croydon, and yeah, I guess it's all relative, as they say, when this is showing me a clip from a movie yesterday.
There is a very seriously posh part of Croydon. I've been to both parts a number of times, so I've got some very good friends in both, so...
But they've got a real NIMBY culture there, where I had a meeting with one person who's, because we're doing supported accommodation next to them. They put in 350 objections, right? And they said, well, you wouldn't live next to these people, would you? I was like, excuse me? And they're like, you wouldn't live next to these people. Like, just, they made that assumption based on me, not knowing that outside my front window to the left there now, I can see one hostel. I can see, if there was not a wall there, there'd be another one. There, and there's another one there. So I've got three of the biggest, and they're actually for active substance users, right? Mm-hmm. And these people, and they're friends. I think everybody, and I'm not a social justice warrior. I think people will realize that talking to me, but I think everyone deserves a chance, right? And everyone has to have an environment where they can build something good out of their life. And I just hope that Aparo is able to do that for people, to provide them affordable, good quality, safe accommodation for the long term. That's all I really want to do with my businesses. And in the meantime, build something and have fun building it, be challenged every day. That's what motivates me.
And just for the listeners' benefit who didn't have a pen handy, which they're running to get now to write down, so it's Toby Wild and oparo.co.uk. So not .com, oparo.co.uk.
Great.
Check them out, look them up, get involved. So I'm Will Mallard. This is My Property World podcast. Toby Wild, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together. Whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.